afternoon, and welcome to Cruzmo's Cosmos. This is Janaea, and as usual, we're tickling the belly of the beast here from the heartland of Santa Cruz. And with us today, we have Will Giles. He's a world-renowned photographer, as well as Chuck Davis, who's doing a documentary on his life. He's been working with him for a year. And Will is an amazing human being. He's truly an elder, and I'm very honored to have him here with us. He's traveled extensively throughout the world, and he was born in Boston to a doctor and a concert pianist with his wife. Traveled at the age of one to London, lived among the white people. The age of three, moved to Johannesburg, South Africa, where he learned how to live with the dark people. And those two colors have influenced his photography immensely, as you'll see as we carry on the conversation. We'll be learning about the interplay between light and darkness and shadow, and as well, violence and the role that plays in our lives, particularly after what we've just been listening to. For me, it's been heart-wrenching. George has done an incredible job keeping us all informed of what's going on in Israel and Gaza. And again, you're listening to Freak Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. And I want to let you listen to Will for a little while. He's going to be talking about the healing power of photography in light and the consciousness of light and the different shades of that. And again, Will Giles is here with us now. Hi, Will. Welcome.
Say, tickling the belly of the beast in from the heartland of Santa Cruz.
Yes, that's what we're doing here.
Well, you know, I lived here. Lived here for 12 years, 513 Ocean View. And Blake and I, we brought up kids. Grand three-storied building there. So I feel like a native here. Help save the lighthouse field with the help of many others, especially Ed Porter, if you're listening. You're the supervisor here, I hear tell. I had been with Babaji, with Baba Haridas, for the better part of a year, under training and up in Robles Road up in Bonny Doon. And I saw this man planting a tree and being full of affection, especially with Babaji's way of seeing and feeling the world as one, which is his teaching, even though he doesn't say a word. A remarkable person. So I built a studio there and was there for the better part of 8 years.
And this was at Mount Madonna, or where was
this? No, this was at his home. This was at his home up in Robles Drive, up in... he was living with Marenu, Ruth Horsting, who brought him over from India in 1970. So I met him. He had a workshop at the Lama Foundation. My Lord, in 1970.
Oh, in New Mexico?
In New Mexico.
Oh, my...
So it's interesting how life is, you know, it's not a circle, it's cycles, and you recycle certain times. And if you're a photographer, then you have a record of all that. And if you're a journal keeper, then something magical starts happening because you start seeing your life as a kind of a mythogenic kind of person trying to make sense of what I sense is a very, very stupid world. I mean, how can we continue to be as barbarous as we are? For how long? How long do we keep that paradigm that the only way of settling things is? I mean, not even the Native Indians, not even our Constitution in the United States, which we borrowed heavily on the Iroquois Confederacy. We don't give the Indian much credit. It's their land, for Christ's sakes.
And they contributed the Constitution.
Absolutely.
Leaving out the women and spirituality.
Oy.
But Will, before we came in, we were talking a bit, and you spoke about photography as a healing tool.
Well,
can you address
those of you who are listening, if you this is everything that you need to know about photography in 1 minute, if I can do it. If you can follow this path of doing something. Okay, close your eyes just for a moment. And go into that dark dungeon that's inside, dark cell beings, and then slowly open both your eyes. Then close one so that you're seeing the world just through one eye.
Okay.
And then make a square in one form or another with your hands that you're seeing through with that one eye, like a peephole.
Got it.
And feel each of the corners of that triangle, or well, not triangle, it would be a rectangle. And sense what you're seeing in your body and become one with that little. You can go all the way microscopically to what you're seeing, or not even know if the microscopic way of seeing things becomes totally large. And once you can feel that, then everything that you see is also part of yourself. And once you can do that, I don't think you can treat your neighbor badly, because you see parts of him in you and you in him, and you become one momentarily, especially with photography.
That microcosm and the macrocosm.
There you go. There you go. But it takes doing it a lot, and the digital age has come in, so but you're still seeing the world through a rectangle. And that rectangle is what you keep and you look upon and get information from.
I had a sense of that. I did create that little rectangle, and I could see the darkness of a man in front of me looking into his eyes. He looked very wounded, and at that moment I went into a wounded place in my heart.
Yeah, it's a
somewhere
along the line it's about boundaries. You know, what do you open your hands to in love, or what do you slam the door on and keep out? And I think photography is probably the way that can change the world, because these kids now, what is it, Gore's idea, putting things on YouTube, that kids all over the world can make a little digital, little not a program, but just how they live and the conversations that take place between the people. And it has to be, I think, a little longer than 3 minutes or less than 3 minutes. I'm not sure. But all of a sudden, boom, there you have direct experience of what's going on in the Gaza Strip. And you, with this way of seeing and sensing, you're there. I just feel so intense that the paradigm of how we go about seeing things, of either you're in or out, has simply got to change.
Yeah.
And the Iroquois Confederacy, there were five tribes, and even the white fathers, they were very impressed that all these Indians, with their different traditions, different customs, different ways of doing things, different languages, could become one.
And
say, these barbarians, they still call them savages, et cetera, and you know, they couldn't quite see the Indian way of living.
And they were warring with one another until they came together.
Yeah.
They could see the futility in that.
Yeah.
And they listened deeply within themselves.
Yeah.
And they came up with the Iroquois Nation.
Yeah, the Mohawks from the east, that's where the Mohawk Tea Party came from.
I didn't know
they weren't exactly Indians, but hey, they gave it credit. At least they wore different things that Mohawks would do. I don't think the Mohawks exactly got into the Tea Party, but I think, I'm sure they incited the white folks.
And they gave us true democracy there in his YouTube.
And the Senecas, my tribe, I have a 16th. My great-great-great mother married a medicine man, and my dad, who was a physician, he always was very interested in herbal medicines going back into the turn of the century, last century.
Oh, I bet that didn't sit well with the powers that be.
No, he was a bit of a maverick, you might say.
Is that why you ended up in South Africa?
Yeah, I think so. He was teaching midwives at Tufts University because he felt that women should really be the ones that deliver babies. He felt it was really imposing the white male aspect. And he would look at a doctor and say, well, have you had a baby, doctor? How can you experience that?
And he listened to them. And that was novel, and he was ahead of his time, as your photography is.
It became very successful, so, you know, they had to turn him down. And then he had trouble in London because he picked up, acupuncture from a good, Chinese friend. And proved
that ancient wisdom that was so effective.
In Africa was a little different because the Afrikaners he had trouble with. They have very fundamental aspects that black people were like, our Indian friends here to start with.
Yeah, and how did you end up in Argentina? I know you spent
He was offered a wing in the hospital in Buenos Aires. Well, first at La Plata in Uruguay, and then in Buenos Aires. But all my childhood was down in Argentina. My best friend actually was a horse. I didn't relate, being an only child.
Was that in Patagonia?
That was a long, I got very much into shepherding and there's a certain nomadic quality inside of me. I like people, and then there's another side that bit of a nomadic. Photography is, in some ways, a very alone journey. It's like trying to discover the inside as you're going about in the outside and trying to bring the two together.
And I've noticed that a lot of your photographs beautifully illustrate our natural world and the elements. We were speaking about that a little bit before we arrived this afternoon.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit about that? And how that began for you? Because you so beautifully illustrated. I've had different individuals on that speak about the language of the land, the sacredness of the land. You illustrate it in a way that allows it to be experienced.
Well,
and somehow changes.
I often just purposely try to get lost. It really opens your eye up to really seeing everything as if for the first time. Even around wherever you're living at, you get into a particular pattern of doing one thing very consistently one way, and you really almost don't know what's on the other side of the street. And you can be there for 10 years and still not know. But with nature is so beautiful because all the parts of your body are in nature, and you are nature. And if you allow yourself to the nature of yourself and your being, which is, I've always felt, is a good one. I have trouble with original sin. I can't imagine a baby as Jesus is. I mean, we're in the middle of, religious concepts. We should look at it. We should talk about God. We should, because the religions, they get in the way sometimes of spirituality and they get a little dog-eared and how to integrate that there are many different ways of coming toward the center. And this is what the sacred fire with the Iroquois Confederacy, all five nations, and later the Tuscadores, you had a central fire. And everyone had a say, and often they wouldn't leave the teepee or the longhouse, until there was a consensual aspect, which is very different than, say, our government, where if you get one vote, you're in, and to hell with your opponent or enemy. And it's been barbaric. I really am inclined to blame the Republicans more so than the Democrats, though, you know, money and greed go hand in hand, it seems.
Yeah, and what we're lacking sorely is the ability to truly listen to that silence within ourselves and to come from that place and then make a decision. Listen to what is being said by others as well as the unseen. There is so much wisdom in the silence.
Yeah. And nature doesn't exactly
They're
bark.
Hidden agendas. Yeah. No, it doesn't at all. They're hidden agendas.
They're hidden, you
that
have to
are
be
running.
Real quiet. I tell my students, well, talk to the trees. You know, they're standing people. I've become very Indian. I feel my spirit is Indian. And having to deal with... Now, my dad showed me that we're really all four races in one. And the way he proved it was, okay, you know, have someone bang you somewhere. And first, it turns white. And then slowly it becomes red. And then it gets a little bit bluish and violet. And then slowly goes into yellow. And then it starts itching. And then it goes out. Mm-hmm. So we're all really, all the races contained in one. And I think we live on one world. Where else are we going to go? And how to make it so that I'm... And I have an idea of training or finding some kind of method that children before they're eight can speak four languages. I think just knowing one language is a real limitation of consciousness. Of somehow even our English, where we don't know the roots of our English. I mean, my God, you know, the Bible was written in Greek. Well, there are many, many different ways of, reading the Bible if you go back to the original texts written by many people. And, you know, how to bring the menorahs and the Islamic, what I call the three prophets, somehow desert prophets. For sure, it doesn't include much of the Eastern ways of sensing and seeing things, but we have a dilemma with these desert prophets of Muhammad and
the fundamentalist
Abraham
spectrum.
And Moses and anyway, just a thought.
They tend to bias the perspective. They tend to limit. Yeah. What is encouraged or even allowed in some cases. And this is Free Radio, where we can speak freely. Again, it's Freak Radio 101.1 FM, and feel free to join us by calling 427-3772 or 469-3119. Anyone that remembers Will, when he was living here, he now lives in the Seaside Marina area and came up here today to be on the show with us. And feel free to call in if you want to join in. Again, it's Cosmos Cruzmos. And Will, what did you want to say? We were talking a little bit about consciousness and photography and how the lens can expand that a bit.
Well, the eye that you see the world is the same eye that you talk about as I. You know, I want this, or I want to see this, or I want to get this. So if those two get together, then that little, you know, how many millimeters it is that the light shines into, you know, your dark dome inside. Everything that you see outside is really a reflection of your own particular image of seeing. Mm-hmm. What you see is not the object of what you see, it's the reflected light, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's not just the reflected light, but then it has to go through the kind of eye that perceives it or doesn't perceive it according to the anatomy of the eye, and now it's all physical. It turns itself upside down in image-making form like the camera. The camera is very identical to how the eye works and is, including the digital stage. So it's very personal. The digital stage kind of carries the silver into touching things with your fingertips, which is why we need a new paradigm. And I think the paradigm will probably get changed by the internet and kids talking to each other from all over the world. My kid of 10, you know, amazing that she could just show her parents and this and that and the other and talk to a kid that's in Kenya. And the Kenya kid would send things back. I mean, way beyond me, but I could see, oh, how beautiful. I mean, how neat, because we all want to be loved. And well, anyone who's here listening to this does not want to be loved. I haven't really. Unless, you know, there's something really, really hurting inside and you just want to say to hell with everything and you put a bunch of, you know, dynamite around you and blow yourself up with as many people as you know how. Well, that's not really the answer. No. It really isn't.
And there's so much fear right now that has been generated, fear of not having a home, fear of losing your job, your income, your status.
Photography can give you your own individual sovereignty and a record of that sovereignty by how you go about seeing something. It's only you that's seeing this, and you have to learn to honor yourself for seeing something like that. I mean, when I was coming back from getting Christmas stuff, and there was a car that got stopped at a red light, and out of nowhere there were like five police cars around it, and they smashed the window and pulled this guy out and you know, essentially threw him down on the ground. And I was in the car, so I only got a small glimpse. I thought I was on television. You know, and I looked around to see if there was a television. This was right on Del Monte in Marina. And I felt it so deeply inside of me. It's an amazing that you can have a 15-second impulse of something like that, and it leaves an image. And it just didn't feel quite right. But, hey, I try to tell people at least there's two sides to everything. If we can at least start with that, to learn to sit down and thank God that Obama is in. Thank God that he's in. Because we wouldn't be able to stand another. I'm the decider. Well, you decided wrong, baby. You did. You didn't. I say it to you from brother to brother. I mean, you didn't look at the facts. You were told by people who had their own agendas, and we're in the mess we are in now. And it hurts my heart.
He's got a lot to clean up. And you were telling me that you had so many Obama signs outside your home that
16
people
posters.
Thought that it was the head Democratic headquarters.
Yeah. Well, I had this.
It didn't surprise me in the least to know that. You even showed me a photograph of it.
I just felt you got
to
do.
It's time to jump in.
You got to do more than just, this is true. We're going to change. And with Obama in, and if he can get that internet going and get, you know, I mean, I'm just, it's in the kids' hands. I mean, we've got to learn to have a society that takes care of its youngest and its oldest and bring the two ends of that pole together in one form or another. And photography is, I think, the immediate way of transcending this and that and the other, because you're right there and you have your own sovereignty of seeing what you see. I mean, you can censor things for a while, but not with this little radio station, and this is all over the place.
Yes, it is.
And the airwaves should be free. And I feel
absolutely
that about water, too. But, you know, we won't get into that one. I mean, where does people, we the people, and where did pursuit of happiness go? And somehow, you know, in some ways you got to go back in time to our Indian brothers. I mean, we did we did a trashy aspect to this, and they have so much to teach, so much. I'll never forget going out in the desert with, I guess there were 12 people with me. We built a fire. This was in Arizona, outside of Flagstaff. And we stayed out all night, just formed a ring around the fire, our heads toward the fire, and took in these, you know, the gorgeousness of all the stars. Mm. And I remember being with my dad in Machu Picchu when I was 8. And there's a little sacrificial altar space which you can lie on. I don't know about now. There, people probably tell you not to do that, but this was some time ago. And he had me close my eyes, and this was at nighttime. And, well, first seeing all the stars, and then close your eyes, and then he would, said, well, do you see all the stars? Yeah! And I feel that your photographs, one's photographs, if you have a record of them, are points of light. Points of light, the interaction between you and how you've seen, how your eye sees. And we each is true as the lines in your hand, and astrological aspects, if you go deeply enough. I mean, most people don't know that maybe we've replaced the S-U-N with the S-O-N on various avatars of the past. And, for instance, the 12 signs go to the 12 people that followed Jesus, the 12 disciples. There's so many superimposable forms of thought going on now.
And what can you say about the S-U-N superimposing the S-O-N? Or the S-O-N superimposing the S-U-N?
Yeah. I mean, being Indian, and in terms of my own spirituality, though, you know, I went to my son-in-law's, he's a pastor in Christian church, and they're bringing the church back to life in some ways without necessarily being dogmatic, but with music. And it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I mean, I think we need a hell of a lot more music, song, and dance somehow, somewhere, so that it lightens the heavies that get you depressed and make you eat bonbons and feel, you know, that you don't have anything. I mean, you are your own boss inside, and you can see certain things and make an art of it. I think that's the best. Then you can share that. I mean, what nicer thing than being on radio with you and talking about how you go about seeing. This is fun. And
it is.
And having Chuck here and, you know, getting things filmed, and I think this is all really quite marvelous. And also, it's the first day. First day of 2009, so this is the platform, baby, you know. Set this one day up of how you kind of want to jump into your own individual sovereignty, which is what the Indian taught us when the white people came way, you know, 1620, way before that, asked who your chief was. And the guy that was there, he said, we're all chiefs. What do you want? This is our own transmission. There was also a couple of others. One was, this was Lauren Lyons, who's the peace carrier for the Senecas, or has been for some time. He said, oh, you white folks, you're going to have trouble. You all have slaves. Who wants to be a slave? You want to be my slave? I don't want to be your slave. You know, get rid of slaves. You're going to have trouble. And then at nighttime, you know, we go back to the camp where our women are, and we talk to them until 2, 3 in the morning, and sometimes they come too. Where are all your women? You seem to treat them like property or something, like, you know, like your possessions. You're going to get in trouble for that. And the last oral transmission, which affects our days now, you don't listen to your kids. You don't listen to your kids. And parents now, you know, they're so caught up with being busy. I mean, you know, I've got six children and four grandchildren, I feel like an old oak tree. You know, as you get older, you branch out more. You have more of an oversight on things.
What do you learn from the kids, Will? What can you learn from the kids?
Oh.
Tell me.
Vitality. Yes.
You've got that so alive in yourself.
How could I not? It'll keep you young, baby. Yeah, still, you can jump.
One never knows what's coming
forward. I'm wanting to skydive this year.
You know?
I've always wanted to skydive, and I've been told, look, it's pretty safe now, et cetera. You get some guy that's willing to. And I just love to see, because part of my naming is Eagle, and another thing they mentioned, which is interesting, they said, oh, you people, you don't, yeah, apparently Europe had totally killed all the eagles, so we picked the white eagle, and they said, oh, you're going to have trouble there. You know, white eagle, I mean, it's the golden eagle that goes, touches the sun. White eagle's a bit of a scavenger. He eats other people's kill.
Oh, yeah, we did have a war.
And look at our history. I think if we got back to Indian basics, this would be a great, great
nation.
Country, because this was Atlantis here. We just didn't realize it.
No, we didn't. And if you want to join us, feel free to call 427-3772. And with us also is Chuck Davis, who is quite a photographer in his own right. He's traveled extensively with Cousteau. And let's let him speak a bit. What do you want to say? He's doing a documentary right now. He's been following Will around for over a year, and Will asked if he could join us. And I said, sure, and been talking with him a bit before the show. And, man, he has a lot to share, the two of them together. Can really banter. And Chuck, what do you want to say for yourself over there?
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I'll put the camera down and turn the lights off here for a minute.
Great.
It's been an amazing journey Will and I've been on. This last year, I've been filming a documentary about his life, and in a year I've scratched the surface, really. I knew Will's work long before I actually met Will, and probably 10 years ago, I heard Will lecture at the Ansel Adams Gallery when it used to have a gallery down in Cannery Row, and we were both artists that were represented there. And he gave a talk one night that just knocked me off my fins. It really did. I realized that the work and the man, they were, of course, that's how we would be, of course. You know, I was just like, wow. You know, sometimes you meet somebody, an artist, a musician, and you've known the work for years, and then you meet the person. Sometimes it just goes the other way, and you go, it's just a lot different than you thought. I mean, this way, with Will, he was just kind of exactly the way I thought he probably would be, through his work. And you realize with Will, as I've gotten to know him more, and I've spent a lot of time filming, and also with the camera off sometimes, just talking with him philosophically and whatnot, that there's a lot more to the artist than just the prints that you might be lucky enough to see out there in galleries. And he's well represented. His work's... You know, he's a world-class artist, but you start to realize how much of his writings and his journals. If you have lunch with Will, or you visit him, he'll have his journal with him. It's right there on the table.
See? Yeah,
he always and it's an
right
amazing.
Here.
And those aren't casual writings. Those are we filmed those and made them part of the film. I realize how important his writings and his philosophy and Will the man and his photography. It's all one. It's all part of the art. It's all part of the man. And, you know, the word spirituality is used kind of casually these days. You hear it a lot. But I mean, in Will's sense, I really feel like he's the most, you know, spiritual person I've met. And it comes out in his work. You'll see some of his subjects that have very defined lines to them. And you can say, well, that's, you know, maybe it's a landscape or maybe it's a famous screech owl. And they're wonderful images. But you also see work that he's done that, say, we might use the word abstract, but really, it's all the same. It's all the same spirit. It's all the same stuff. All those elements that are there are through the universe, and they're in his work, and as you look at it more, you realize, you kind of go, wow. It's like, you know, that's what I did, and I've spent hours filming, doing, you know, cinematic moves on Will's work at his studio as part of this film that we're doing. And I remember just one of the first afternoons just noticing, you know, compositions within the composition, worlds within his imagery. And I was just, I was just spellbound. Will and I kid about it sometimes because I got into some of these prints and Will would leave the studio temporarily, come back, I'd still be filming it, and he'd start laughing. I said, man, there's a lot going on in these images, you know? And like I say, I've just scratched the surface on his work. But we still have a little ways to go on the filming. But it's been an amazing journey for me. I've learned a lot. And it's been really an honor and a privilege, really, to spend all this time with Will. And we're still...
Well, likewise, ditto this way. Isn't it interesting that... We're reflections of each other, so why not put on the best person that you are inside? Because that part, for the first day, is then reflected back on you. Dare open the gates of your own heart. I dare you. And remember that it isn't you trying to knock a door to get into your own house. You're already in your own house. You just simply need to open the doors of your own fear. Say hello. What's wrong with that? Smile more. Have that little glint that, yes, that's what the Obama spirit is. That's what he's catalyzing in all of us. And whatever talents that you have, I mean, photography has been mine because it helps focus. But it can be dancing. It can be singing. It can be the sense of consciousness that maybe there isn't justice for younger people or blacks. I mean, our penology system is the most atrocious in the European. I mean, ha! And, you know, saying fun, you know, with torture. I mean, good Lord, look at the heritage of the last, let's say, the last 8 years. I mean, from bad to worse, and it makes it... I think enough already. Let the religions just be.
And on that, you brought some beautiful music here. I'm going to see if I can take a... Do I want to take a break for a moment?
Oh, absolutely.
What did you bring? Let me see if I can get that started. What did you bring? I have it up here. It's in the DVD now. Let's see if
Kevin
we can get
Locke,
this going. Oh.
Midnight Strong Heart. It's great traveling music. Anytime you have a long distance ride to go. Like all my kids, they live so far, and often kids don't come and visit you. You got to visit them. But that's okay as long as I can ride, and then I listen to the radio, you know, listen to music.
Let me see if I can get that started here. Just a moment. Excuse me, folks. I'm still learning some of this.
What's that?
Oh, that's sounds, not what we want to
like we're
be
bringing
hearing,
in the
I
UFOs here.
It did sound like
you should
Kevin
tell
Locke,
people
though.
The number too, if anyone wants to call.
Yeah, call us. Feel free to call us at 427-3772.
I'm better with questions. It's too
Let's
much
see.
Nebulae.
Here we go. Kevin Locke for you, folks. We'll be right back. Oh, that was beautiful. That's Kevin Locke, Midnight Strong Heart. And you're listening to Cosmos and Cruzmos, Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. If you want to give us a call, feel free to call 427-3772 or 469-3119. We have with us two amazing photographers, Will Giles and Chuck Harris. We're going to be talking right now about cataloging photographs and cataloging our lives, how to keep a record of our lives, what it means. Will, what are we trying to say here? Help me with this. We were just talking about it. Well, I loved what you were just sharing with me. I'm having a hard time paraphrasing it.
At least if you were to assemble all the pictures that you've taken, you know, snapshots of this, that, or Polaroids, or anything photographic as such, you know, going back to tintypes or daguerreotypes, they're all what I would call visual material or photo material. Now, if it has a stamp on it, has a date on it or a place, it becomes a record, especially with a time chronology on it and a time and place. And that's, you know, it's at least it takes it out of the huge reservoir of photo material. But that's just the beginning of a kind of a step wedge, and it gets fewer and fewer as you get higher and higher in terms of consciousness. If you're wanting now to document something, to leave a document, a legal tender as such, or a way in which you're wanting to persuade or convince someone of something, you know, prove that you were in Paris, so, hey, man, Lenny, you know, stand a little over there. Get that Eiffel Tower behind you. Yeah, yeah. And Joni, you come up so, you know, it kind of shows. Well, that's a beginning of kind of documentation, as these kids are doing with Gore's idea of showing with video, because it's all pictures. Out of any single frame in a video, you can make a still picture. I think to a large extent, I'm talking more of stills than motion, because there's some prerequisite work to be done visually, I think, from the still. Once you get a little more professional and you want to do it, you know, as a means of making some money from it, it's not just getting Aunt Minnie close to the Eiffel Tower, but putting up some lights in a certain way and have something different. And, you know, if it's fashion, have some woman in silk gown flashing in front of strobe lights or something like that for a Vogue. And they're far fewer than just visual material or records of everyone's travels. And if you do the illustration, you know, as well as you can, somewhere along the line, you start sensing that your own particular way of seeing the world has its own stamp, its own identity. And by that, it starts mirroring the books you're reading, the people you hang out with, your habitat, and the concerns that you have while you're here at this particular moment, you know, being here now more. And there's nothing like photography to focus that kind of intent. And the realization of yourself through it in the direction that you want to take, that's the blessing.
Can you give some examples in your own life of how you've done that?
Yeah, sometimes they come at you, you know, right from the top down, like Screech Owl was a phenomena of an owl coming from the ocean side when I was doing a workshop up at Mendocino. And this screech owl came in from the ocean and banged on a car in front of me and was there floundering in the road. I stopped my car to pull it across, you know, tell cars to go around me. And I couldn't pull it off because it was really in huge claws. So I got my focusing cloth, you know, went back to the car and threw it over the this bird. I wasn't sure what it was to begin with, and pulled it off. And when I opened the focusing cloth, you know, about a 3 foot by 4 foot piece of dark cloth, it had against the black, its feathers just gleamed. They were luminescent. And whenever I see that in nature, I become a little kid. I run to get my camera quick because everything can change so fast, you know, in that kind of light. And so I got the camera and got it on the tripod and composed the bird within the framework. It was all crouched and, you know, it was obviously going to die. And I got everything focused, and then just at the last moment when I was about to pull the trigger, you don't want to really touch the camera because the process of touching it moves it. So I like to be really sharp and in focus, and boom, it just went, opened its wings.
Wow.
I fell back. The camera fell on top of me. Somehow I must have scuffed up earth so that my mouth was, you know, as if I had been buried or something. There was this huge white light that I couldn't get up right away. I don't know how long I was, you know, there on the side of the road. And my first thought, you know, as a photographer, back to left lobe from right lobe. And, well, did you take the picture?
Had you?
And I did, and it was absolutely perfect. So as it opened its wings, my camera kind of tilted at the same parallel as its wings did. And Ruth Barnhard was those of you who are photographers and probably know her, we were doing a back-to-back workshop at the Mendocino Art Center, and she said, "Well, what happened here?" And and she had a friend, Little Joe, from the Taos Pueblo, and he loved this picture. He looked at it for the better part of 5 minutes and said, "Well, what happened here?" And I told him the story, and he said, "Well, you know, he didn't care about the details. He was, well, what happened to you?" And Indians, man, they go right for your throat, you know, right to your heart. I mean, there's a certain, you know, innocence in a lot of them. And he said, "Well, don't you know about the owl?" He said, "If you're connected in that kind of healing way of becoming that which you're looking at, you could be taken out."
You mean?
Just, you know, it would be such a shock on your system, having a pet that would. So he said, "Well, but you're still here. I guess you got more pictures to take." and that starts way at the top, and then somewhere, Ansel Adams would tell me, you know, if you get five at the most, really, really good pictures in a lifetime, you're doing pretty good. That's how rare those pictures are.
And this is what is the name of this photo?
This is Screech Owl.
Screech Owl.
Yeah, for anyone out there that would love to see a really beautiful silver gelatin print of it right now, is on display at the Center for Photographic Art, and Carmel Will's work is included in a show. It was curated by Kim Weston along with 37 artists, but it's one of the centerpiece photographs in the show, and it's really a powerful image when you see it. It's something to see an image online, maybe in pixels, but when you see the real print itself displayed, and that's a silver gelatin print, it's pretty magical to actually stand next to that, you know, properly lit. There's a certain energy there you just don't get looking at it any other way.
And
that's at the Center for Photographic Art, which is in Carmel. It's in San Carlos.
And you're the director.
Yeah, we're sort of heavily involved in running it. We're rebuilding. We're sort of rebuilding right now, and you know, just restoring, I should say. But there was a show that it's been up for a while. It'll be up to January 5th. But if you wanted to see that's one of Will's really signature images. A beautiful image. It'll be up through the 5th of January. You can still see it, and that show.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, the Center for Photographic Art has been renamed a couple of times, but it goes back to the Friends of Photography in the early 70s.
In Carmel.
So it's in Carmel. Yeah,
it's Monterey County.
That gallery, the gallery space itself has probably a 40-year history of being a gallery for photographic art. And back to, the Friends of Photography originally were in that space. And then when they went up to Northern California, there was another group that was formed, the Monterey Peninsula Photographic Center. I hope I pronounced that right. It was the Photographic Center of Monterey Peninsula.
Yeah, and then later Roger Vermeer.
Yes, and then later the name was changed to this just the Center of Photographic Art.
And Dennis High was leading the way for a period of time, didn't
right,
he?
For 17 That's right. years.
Well, everything changes. In order to grow, I guess everything changes.
Oh, it has to. But not everyone looks at change as opportunities.
Oh, no.
To grow.
Ooh, yeah.
I can myself attest to that. It can be very. I'm going to put on the brakes. The screech will be a halt. Yeah. Abrupt.
I think what Will was alluding to earlier is pretty important information in terms of photography, in terms of levels of photography. And, mm-hmm. and again, I consider myself a student, a Willie's very much my mentor. But you really think a long time about what he's saying about some
I'm
of those
learning
those things.
As much from you.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Well. Anyway, there's really something to be said about the intent behind the camera, and sometimes that's very. There's a certain amount of manipulation that goes on creatively with lighting, and maybe with a model, or maybe with a subject, whatever. Sometimes it happens in a photojournalistic sense. It still is very artful. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the things that Cartier-Bresson did or James Natchway that are recording events that are very important in a very artful way. I mean, how do you define art? That's a tough one. But I mean, I always tell people I know it when I see it. That's probably not a good answer, but right, I know it when I feel it, I should say. But and then there's some photography that's just done, and I do that myself sometimes, purely for documentation, literally for a record of something. And my intent isn't necessarily to express a particular feeling, but other times I really am trying. I'm not sure I always succeed, or every photographer succeeds, like Will was saying. If you're in a lifetime, if you have a half a dozen real winners, you know, you've done pretty well. And some photographers do better than others, but you can take a lifetime achieving a portfolio like that. That's truly stuff that's just truly important. Mm-hmm. Not an easy thing to do.
So you tend to do look at the symbolism behind what you've photographed, or is it an interplay? Is there a communication between yourself and what you're photographing? I'm not a photographer. I don't know how it develops, how you create it, how you interact with what it is you're photographing.
A lot of times, decision for me, it's about capturing a feeling and the way a subject makes me feel and the way I want to convey that feeling. That there's something going on that's definitely sensory. When I'll see it, maybe something down on a very abstract level, perhaps, or maybe not. But there's just something that you're out in the world. And I shoot underwater a lot, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. You just something hits you, a subject or a situation that captivates you, and that's the magic of it, I suppose, for lack of a better word. And I think it's an attempt to convey that feeling or emotion or a love of something, mm-hmm. to share it. And I think, you know, sometimes photographers, I've heard some great photographers that say, I photograph for myself. I don't care what other people think. I photograph for me. And that's mm-hmm. that works for a lot of artists. Some artists feel that, until the piece of artwork has an audience, a receiver, that they don't feel it's completed. So that's another way of looking at it. I'm not sure which. Maybe they both work, but it seems like, I know my own personal work, I feel like I do want someone to receive that and be part of that experience that I'm putting into a print.
So what have been some photographs that you've taken, Chuck or Will, some more at that the beginning, something where you were moved, something you were moved to photograph intentionally, and you found that and...
Well, with nature, nature speaks very quietly, especially if it's if you're down among a bunch of rocks, you got to be very, very patient with rocks.
Hmm.
And you have to become a rock, just like you have to become a tree if you're looking at a tree. I swear, in one picture, the snowy trees, after I took the picture, I felt we both bowed to each other. We both respected the, what is it, the namaste. The spirit inside of us respects the spirit outside of you. In Indian culture, trees are people. Mm-hmm. They're not just square footage of wood. They're real people. We call them standing people. And it affects how you see if you think that way. Of course, it depends on how it is that you want to project out. If you, a lumberer, you think, hey, this is so many square footage and we can make a couple of thousand on this. And that's how the world works. Each person has their own particular perspective. My life has been spent to a large extent is showing how to have compassionate pictures, how to feel what you're taking a picture of, how to be a symbol, how to be a metaphor. And this is as things I'm working on the inner world. And hopefully it can help others. It can liberate others from their own fears. And then go out, and my dad, you know, when he would get me over fear of bugs and this and that, and say, well, how many legs does it have? Way early, so you have to get down your knees and count them.
Get to know it.
Get to know it.
Befriend it.
And we're not living in a very trusting world. And I think the way to change is just change yourself if you can and just say, God damn it, I'm going to be really happy. Somehow, this is the first day, I'm going to treat myself good. Mm-hmm. And it'll be amazing how it's picked up by people. I dare you to try it. Of course, you might get punched out by someone who thinks, hey, he's off his rocker. But that could be an interesting experience also. At least you're alive.
Depends. Yeah, it's true. I lived in a rather dangerous area in Seattle for a while, and I swear that people could smell my fear.
Yeah.
And when I recognized that, I didn't become cocky or arrogant. I just had no fear.
Yeah,
I couldn't. I knew it was my survival. So
yeah.
And just said, walk like you're not in fear.
Well,
and as I did that, I didn't feel fear. And I started smiling and asking people brazenly what time it was. And they were kind of protective every time they saw me after that. Oh, she's fine.
Yeah. Well, with women, just have a definite intention of where you're going. And no one's going to bother you.
Or smile.
Yeah. But just that fact that they're women and, you know, and men and gays, lesbians, I mean, it's not just bicameral. Actually, the study of the brain is that they're finding it's within the right and the left, that's divided too, mm-hmm. which really allows in the lesbian aspects and the homosexual aspects. I mean, that's another belly of the beast. Which should be looked at. With Indians, we always looked upon people.
It's very natural.
They're different, you know. They like to do other things, but often they were healers.
Yeah, thank goodness.
And storytellers, and they
like
taking care of the kids and the old people. What's wrong with that? For crying out loud! And I would dare say, if it really wasn't for a lot of, you know, I mean, I'm heterosexual, but I'm not against the other. And I would dare say, you know, you probably have to take away the field of dancing and a lot of the arts, for crying out loud. We're allowed to make your life on the right side of the brain. We're so left-brained of accounting and columns and figuring things out and footage. And I mean, it's amazing we can walk.
I know.
And our head should
be
totally off balance.
Grown. Yeah, it really has. I think we're seeing the beginnings of more, not just tolerance, but respect for one another.
Yeah.
And that's why I say on this show, we're tickling the belly of the beast, because we're living in it.
Yeah.
We've been a very aggressive nature, a nation.
And the belly of the beast is also inside of you.
Yes.
That's the one that you have to open the door to. And you will not take this person inside. Yeah, fire. Burn it out.
That belly, yeah.
Dare it.
Constantly.
I'm all Pisces, you know,
so
I have two fish.
Digesting the belly of the beast.
Going in opposite directions. And I finally figured that they both are okay because one is going around the world this way and the other is going around the other way. So they're both right. Even the Indians knew that this world was round.
Yeah, so everything
and the Chinese did, too.
It goes back. Well, just like you and I, we can go off on tangents. I'm fully aware of this. I'm experiencing it, and I love it. Yet I promised our listeners that we would talk about photography as a healing tool.
Oh.
We can give them something specific.
Well, healing tool probably won't happen until you get to... beyond just a visual material, click, click, that almost the camera. I mean, this is the downside, shall we say, to the digital thing, because it's so easy, and you can take so many. I mean, like, I did a workshop in which, well, how many did you take? And the person answered, oh, about 500,
oh,
and I took 3. I just had to laugh.
Excuse me, we have a caller here, a little listener. Continue. Well, I'm just going to answer the phone.
Oh, okay. Okay, but I don't think you get a you don't get even a document unless you're putting your focus on what you're seeing. But I think once you start feeling with a degree of compassion. You might be looking at that little kid, you know, on a tricycle, and it's going in front of you, and all of a sudden it falls off, and if you really are looking at it, you can feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And you flinch, you know, just like what I was saying, the person that was dragged out of a car. I mean, I physically felt him being smashed to the ground. I'm not sure if... You know, if that was the best way of doing it, and sometimes maybe not. I'm not making a judgment, but it certainly affected my sensorial body. And often, those are the things that wake you up. And if those different things happen enough times, you'll hang out, say, with the police, be an ambulance chaser or whatever, like Ouija was. You know, in New York, a newspaper photographer and... You know, the newspapers, you know, blood leads, so if it's really gory, like, it makes front news. I mean, good news is just not news.
I think some photographers, like a work of Eddie Adams, or late Eddie Adams, or I think of James Natchway, too, I guess, and others that have documented wars and atrocities, and there's a photography can be such a powerful tool to convey a situation, shall we say. And I guess ideally you do it objectively, but I don't know if every photographer can really be objective. But the power, you feel that. You struck a chord that you actually can feel that when you... Remember the image in Vietnam of the South Vietnamese, I guess it was an officer, who he executes a suspected victim right on the spot. I remember seeing that as a
right
kid,
on the spot,
man,
with a little revolver,
just,
boom.
That just went through me, and I was, you know... pretty young then, but I mean, you think of those kinds of images that in one image, in one click of a shutter, that went out through the whole world.
Memorable.
And you see, you just see those types of things can really enlighten people, show people what's going on. And let's say what's going on in Rwanda, for example, some of the images I've seen that are just, most people, it kind of went under the radar. We're a photographer that really is embedded. It can be very dangerous work. Well, it is a very dangerous work. It takes a lot of dedication, but those types of...
actually radical and quite revolutionary.
In terms of photojournalistic type work, but it's to me, mm-hmm. it's art, too. It's another mm-hmm. form of expression in photography in that really...
so many venues, from what I'm learning from you, too.
There is no end to it. And now that we're going into a digital age, my sensibility is that there are points of light now. And I think there's going to be some really, really interesting sound and sight revelations that will open up our own consciousness. And I think the kids... We can learn from the old folks. That's cool. You know, as I get a little older, I'll be 75 in 3 more months. But thank God I got grandchildren, because Sarah, my 10-year-old, she picked up my little cell phone, and within 5 minutes or so, I couldn't even get it back from her after a good half hour. She had the thing playing tunes. There was all sorts of things, you know, that she could pick up. She'd leave a message to. So I think the best thing of getting old is to get young, because there is something to say. I guess there's this movie now that you're born old, and as you go toward your death, you get younger.
Oh, Benjamin, the curiosity of Benjamin Button.
But you know what? There's something about older people, for those of you who've taken care of older people and are ready to go to the other side, there's a childlike quality to them. They can leave seed thoughts to you. And those thoughts are very precious. Mm-hmm. And they can transform your life. So bringing the oldest with the youngest, we got a big job to do. And do something with the penology system. Now, the best way, it's tricky, you know, because everything is close guarded.
Or criminology? What? Penology, the penal system.
Penal, yeah. That P word.
Oh. Okay.
We won't even say it, but that's basically what it's about.
Uh-huh.
You're under my control, and
right. Yeah.
And you have the controllers, and then you have people that kind of want to play. And
yeah.
It's an interesting beast inside of, but I think the worst beast inside is fear.
Yeah.
And preventing yourself from picking up a camera and just go. You know, if you want to cover something, whatever it is, you really get there like the farmer's market or something, and you get there early when nothing is there, and just see how it slowly develops through the day. Take time to create images. They're not just going to come. And that's just the beginning part. The second part is hold them still somehow. Get the pictures out. Get some tacks or something. Put them up, because these are your starlights. You are a star. I feel that every person is a star. Mm. We just have forgotten which star and what our star means, or what our destinies really are. And we don't really keep much footnotes about who we are. Mm. And photography is a graphing way of putting light into some kind of form so that we can see it like a star. Oh. Now, that's the beginning part. Now see the patterns. See which is the northern star, which goes to your right, which goes to the left, which little starlights like to be hang around each other. And then if it's like the farmer's market, all right, that, you know, that is one envelope, farmer's market stuff. And then out of a bunch of thousands, which is no problem now, you can... You can make a feeling of the morning opening up, and these different people setting up, and the conversations, and hola amigo, ¿qué estás haciendo? It helps too, knowing different languages. I'm wanting to find a system or a model of teaching kids before they're 12, 4 languages. Because I think the mind works in 4 different positions. And you can see things from many, not just one way, but turn it around, see it from the backside and top and bottom. So it's an evolutionary, it's a spatial world, one world, one people. And how to make it into the kind of earth that we'll be proud of, because it was pretty beautiful when the Indians were here. It really was, and I think we should give a little credit to these people for thousands of years.
It was a paradise here on the Central Coast,
yeah.
From what I hear.
Yeah, they say a squirrel could go from Mississippi all the way to the East Coast without touching land.
Okay.
A farmer's almanac. You get great insights. So, I suggest to all of you, get a farm. I mean, it's the greatest little book for $6. It shows you the tides, you surfers, you know. It has everything. It has great articles and, you know, down to earth. And they, in a very subtle way, kind of connected with a little bit of astrology, but, you know, they don't make a big issue of it. And that's also kind of neat. They just kind of say, well, did you know that the disciples maybe were astrological signs? And maybe the S-U-N came from the S-O-N.
So why are so many afraid to speak about that? There's a, seems to be a filtering of what we're encouraged to think about.
Right and lobe, left lobe. A lot of fear of right lobe. Of those who want to be in control.
I sometimes feel that fear. Well, what can you do? What do you suggest I could do about it?
Focus on a particular thing and go deeply with it. Mm-hmm. Like Chucky, I mean, he feels more at home.
He just goes with it and runs with it.
I actually do. I feel safer in the ocean than I do when I'm driving on the freeway going to Los Angeles to a meeting or something, and people think I'm crazy. I had a long talk with my brother
about that. Your photography is so unique.
A few months ago,
it's underwater.
But it's just, it's how you perceive it. But I really think there's, it does feel safer. So, but it took years, you know, years of being in there. And but I was attracted to it as a little kid. Really, it just feels like a place where I should be, and I'm very respectful of it. You could disappear out there very quickly if you weren't very respectful. It takes a lot of respect, but I feel very at home there, you know. And I think that's where I've been attracted to shoot the most images. Some
you
people
get
ask
to be
me
with the dolphins.
Yes, and we're talking earlier about we touched on a little bit on what motivates, I guess, or what about the different types or levels of photography, I guess, and those when there's a certain intent there. That something special happens sometimes. Hopefully it happens. But in the ocean, I've had some pretty amazing experiences with. I like to film marine mammals, and I filmed them and I've shot still pictures of them. But I felt certain connections sometimes with whales. That obviously, you know, I can't swim as fast as a whale, but they have to almost offer themselves to you. They really do. They really have to, pretty much. I mean, you might get a whale swimming by, okay, get a brief encounter, but I've had whales that truly have lingered for a while. And even some other bigger animals, too, sharks and things that have lingered, and they're going, hey, who are you? What are you all about? You know, I've had pods of dolphins out in the Pacific that have zoomed in on me, and I just felt this connection. You know, you can hear you can hear them, you know, they're sending all these little squeaks and pops, and they're intrigued, very intelligent, very curious, and it felt like there was just this little moment they provided. I have dreams about it. Sometimes I'll dream about whales visiting me in my sleep, and I'll wake up and go, darn,
that was it.
But I've been there in Patagonia one time. I remember working with Roger Payne years ago, filming down there and being out with these southern right whales and two adults and a calf. And I got sandwiched between two whales. And a little calf went right between my flippers. And I never laid even a flipper on. I could have been squished like a little neoprene pizza. But they knew I was there. But it just felt like it was something where they knew I was there. And they knew how fragile I was. And they controlled things. You know, I was just there as a guest. And Roger told me that. He said, just go out there. They're very gentle. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah,
sure.
I'm very, very respectful of large animals. But that's happened to me a lot. On many happy underwater occasions, I've just felt that feeling like I'm just, the ocean was offering something to me, kind of that feeling. It's hard to put that into words, but
I think you have to have that respect.
Yeah. And humility.
Humility,
and
humility,
yeah. Or they would
like, whoa, you know, you're much, much, much bigger than me.
Yeah, I think being people that,
to go down there and trust like that.
Yeah, I think people that work on the water or work under it, the people that make their living on the sea, are very humble and usually very respectful of the sea. And it's a good thing. They're just. It's nice to know that there are larger forces out there than us, and we're just. I taught my son how to dive. That's one of the things I just constantly tried to just stress with him, is that, you know, every time you go in the ocean, it's a place you can have a lot of fun and have some amazing experience, but always just be respectful. Because, you know, it's a much bigger forest than us, and that's what makes it so cool to go there, you know. You know.
You're constantly living on the edge down there. The risk is ever prevalent.
Yeah. But it's funny, people see it as a, understandably, people see it as another, quote, world. And I can understand that. It's a logical assumption, but really when you start to spend time in the ocean or on it, you start to realize it isn't another world. It's part of this world. It's connected to us. It's inextricably connected to us. There's no terrestrial world and ocean world. It's just a world. It's all connected. It's the same stuff. And what happens in the ocean and happens on the lands, they balance each other out. And that's why what we do on land, you know, affects what goes on the ocean, vice versa. Mm-hmm. But you see those wonderful NASA photographs taken from the moon or from the space shuttle, and what color do you see looking back? Mostly blue.
It's
maybe planet ocean, but really it's all one thing. And that's what I guess in my own personal work I've tried to convey, that it's that connection. You know, even if you could live in Kansas, still the ocean affects you every day. And the hydrologic cycle and the way the weather goes and the wind goes, you know, it's
the bodies of water.
Yes, absolutely.
We've got the ocean right here. I love the way you're sharing this with us.
Well, I'm very happy to.
It's bringing it home.
Chuck's like a walking ocean. And that's what we are, too, in terms of water.
What documentary did you produce?
Well, I didn't produce. I've filmed as a cinematographer, either a camera operator or a director of photography. I've worked on a number of... I was doing a lot of IMAX shows. IMAX has slowed down for me now. The IMAX world's changing a little bit. But one of the more successful ones was Alaska Spirit of the Wild, that I did a lot of the marine mammal and underwater work for, and the water stuff, some of the glaciation. That was a pretty amazing project in Alaska. And I've worked on a number of other... I've done scenes from various movies like The Living Sea, which we filmed in Monterey Bay, and Greatest Places is another one. Done many, many IMAX shows that I worked on. And I've done a lot of programming for PBS, and I was very fortunate to work on the Cousteau series for a number of years in the 80s and early 90s with Jacques Cousteau and his son Jean-Michel. It was really one of the most amazing experiences of my life. I'm very grateful for it. And I still have worked with Jean-Michel on his PBS series. He has his own foundation, Ocean Futures, but we so still have done work for him since Jacques passed away. So it was an incredible experience. I used to dream about that when I was a little kid. I wanted to be a diver. I wanted to be an underwater photographer since I was a little kid, and I would have dreams about being on Calypso, and it was amazing to actually be there. I used to pinch myself sometimes. It was kind of weird. But dreams can come true, that happens.
You've been where I want to go as well, Tibet, and did some filming up there.
Yeah, we filmed there in the mid-90s for another IMAX film. It was photographically, it was almost shell-shocked. I mean, it would be just pure heaven for whether you're a landscape photographer or if you're more of a person that's more of a cultural conservationist in terms of your work or whatever. It's just there's so much. The image of you there just knocked me out, and I went there almost by accident. I had very short notice. There was another director of photography. I was supposed to shoot it, and there was a family health issue. He couldn't go. I came in on it very last minute, and it was just an amazing experience because I work on the ocean, and there I was up at almost 18,000 feet on the Shangtung. And it was a moving experience. It really affected me. And I'd heard that from people before, and I used to go, well, it's just because of lack of oxygen, your brain's not working. But it really did. It really is a place that really hits you. And I was very grateful for the experience. It really changed my photography, actually. My priorities, I guess. It started got me thinking about things to get away from the ocean a little bit, get way up there. I remember Roger Payne years ago when I was working with him in Patagonia. He said, you underwater photographer, he says, sometimes what you got to do is you got to get out of the water and get up someplace high. I remember telling me that, but he was talking about filming whales from the cliffs to look out or from an airplane. He was right, but I'm thinking that, sometimes if you get away, it helps to get a little distance and to look at things differently. And that was a good experience.
Yeah, well, your eye sees like your eye wherever you are.
Yes.
Wherever you are, there your eye is.
Yeah.
Both of them.
Yeah.
Personal eye and EYE. It kind of challenges, Joseph Campbell's, what photography is neat is that it helps focus that bliss in a way that here you have now. Or it can happen in music. It can happen in any kind of focus of one form or another that you're going to repeat. Yoga is so good. You repeat that and you'll be in pretty healthy condition. If you do photography enough, you'll start opening your heart in many ways, because you start seeing that this is an interesting event that's happening. And with recording, it gives you double satisfaction because then you have something that you can share with someone else. And if there's an artist in you, it's fun creating something, but then underneath it, you really, somewhere along the line, if you had a good childhood, you want to run to somebody and show it. You know, you want to share. I mean, even hard-nosed physicists in their little laboratories, they find a discovery. They want the world to know.
And you're giving them greater insight into themselves and the world at large.
Yeah. I think the audience is important.
Both of you.
Yeah, it's important to have the... You know, the viewer, the receiver, I think to me that's just a vital, personally, it's just a vital part of the whole photographic experience is someone to receive the imagery and share it. We were talking earlier about types of photography and cultural. Some people are doing some pretty important cultural conservation work. I know Ken Parker's been working up, a friend of ours in Tibet, and Chris Rainier, who's been doing some incredible cultural conservation work, documenting peoples and cultures that, you know, may not be here. We hope they are, but they may not be.
If it wasn't for photography, we probably would have a quarter of the national preserves preserved into this day.
I mean,
that was how, because getting all those representatives in Congress to go to Yellowstone or this and that and the other time, and photography came in.
You piqued the curiosity.
Right.
Yeah. And you see, wow, this is beautiful.
I want to go there. Where is it? Who are these people? They need to be saved.
Jacques Cousteau used to have a quote, from the heart, and he used to say that people will protect what they love, and some people might, you know, just cast that off as just a, but he really meant it, and I mean, I've worked with him, and you think about it, when you can connect somebody with something and really create an appreciation for it, you'll have a much better chance of getting someone to understand it and hopefully protect it. Something needs to be protected, and on any, whether it's a land issue or whatever, I mean, you've got to connect people with that, the people that may not be connected with it any other way. I mean, how many people get to go to the highlands in New Guinea, really, to see tribes that are, you know, that may not be there, or peoples that are on the edge of a huge transition zone.
And the Western culture is being exported at such a rapid pace, and their culture is being decimated. It's crucial.
In a way, it's great that photography, especially nowadays, where you could... you know, with the technology we have now, I love analog photography and traditional methods, and I'll shoot those as long as they're available. But you can combine that with the power of the internet and computers, and you can have information around the world on a web very quickly. I mean, to get, you know, if it's a pressing issue, you can get out. Imagine 1800s when something was an issue. It took, you know, imagine getting a letter, you know. now we push a button and email goes zipping across in the other part of the world instantaneously. So that's kind of a good thing in terms of communication.
This is what's really happening. Look at this. Look at these photos. This is what's happening.
Well, in personal relations, you know how awkward it is when two people that are close, all of a sudden, often it's a single word that, you know, or whatever. And then, you know, each one goes their own way, and there's no communication. And oh my God, then it really gets bad because you start projecting all the worst things on the other person. And, you know, you just accelerate it. But all of a sudden you have a picture. And if it was done with kindness and with a sense of, you know, this is who I am, this is who we are. I mean, how could we go about saving our... quote unquote, our children, then go ahead and slaughter other people's children. I mean, I went in myself as a CEO, you know, this was during the end of the Korean War. But, you know, I know what it's like being spat at and told you're a traitor and everything else because you're not following, you know, the command. Thank God there was an admiral who came to my help and said,
I can't see you in the military.
Well,
it
had to
be. Their hands full.
Yeah, because I didn't finish Cornell. I got so impassioned in photography, and so I was eligible, you know, to go into the service.
Were you honorably discharged?
Yeah. I got into it actually. You know, I was a medic, or you know, corpsman in the Navy, and brought three kids into the world. And two tracheotomies, and you know, I was living out all my father's stuff. But
genetic.
I said, no, I don't think it is exactly what I want to do. I'm just a kid.
Well,
you know, what do you know at 20, you know, hardly 20? Well, 21. Wow. And 3 years at Cornell.
Yeah, you've come a long way from there. Wow. You talked a bit about the points of light. Were those the children, the future points of light? a short while ago in our rounded conversation.
Well, if you could just teach children that they have their own light inside. And to allow them to express themselves and not put too much restraints, especially... Because I think if you're not hurt, I mean, that's probably where the first original sin or evil comes from, is when all of a sudden you get abruptly brought front and center on forces beyond you. And this is how it is, and you have to... I mean, I had a 15-year-old difference between myself and my stepbrother, and we did not get along at all. And then I was told that even the Dalai Lama, you know, with his, he did not give his younger brother much sass either. People were thinking, God, maybe we chose the wrong baby. The Tibetan, I feel the Tibetans are, you know, kinship with, you know, the Indians here. They similarities of attitude and ritual and being part of the world that I think we need very desperately, if we can somehow teach kids to enjoy being a kid and to be open to it, and especially the arts. Because in the talking circle, an 8-year-old, if they have something to say, you know, everyone listened. Then you had a women's nation there, too, that had equal rights, so you better listen. So, you know, I think the male-dominated religions as such, I think that has to be looked at when you think about it. Of course, you know, we're kept so busy, you don't have time to think that that has been the way it has.
It's kind of been all-consuming. I think we're fortunate here in Santa Cruz, and there are other pockets within the country, where other perspectives are available.
I think so. And photography, at least with the silver, is also very female. You know, I mean, the silver really is the silver of the moon. It's a filter. It's, you know, the silver lining. And it gives you a graph of what you've, you know, put on it. And it acts as a, you know, reflector of what you've seen outside of you, inside of you. So you have the sun outside, the moon inside. And that's a marvelous sensibility to behold. And you just, you know, again... a sense of respect and humility. I've got to really watch it sometimes, you know, doddering old man, you know, that out of the sheer beauty of something, I can just start crying. And, you know, there can be happy tears too, there can be angry tears, but
your heart is so
Who are your heroes? That defines who you are.
Who are your heroes?
Well, my dad, my ma. And it's taken me a while to integrate the two of them because of... Not that they were the best of parents. My dad really didn't know what the hell to do with me. I was too kinetic and into everything. And you know, I was definitely not his type. But he would slow me down like the Mapuche... Like the, the Micho Picho experience when I was 8 and sensed that the stars, through my father, you know, he showed me how the stars are really inside. But I think if people learn what their bliss is early as possible, then you'll have a fantastic country. You know, because people will be coming direct from where their heart, their mind, and their intellect abide.
That's beautiful. And we're going to have to wrap it up in a few minutes here. And what a statement to give out, to share, to find that bliss.
Thank you for having me.
spread out the noise and the sound.
Yeah. Thanks very
and
much.
Chuck Harris as well. Before I end, though, here, I want to see if you have anything you want to share. Any last-minute thoughts that you want to leave everyone with?
Follow your dreams.
You certainly have.
Let's see. And I'll open my...
Follow that internal drummer, I guess I say, and follow your dreams.
Well, my goodness, he has this huge notebook. Well, because he listens so carefully to what people have shared, and their gems. And he's cataloged them all and written them down, as well as his own thoughts. His mind is active, and he reflects deeply on what he hears.
Well, sometimes it acts as a Pandora's box. You put in a little poem by Thoreau, and I can't find it now. Or maybe it just fell out of it. But it was something, if I can paraphrase it. I don't know how to count. I don't know the first letter to the alphabet. But I regret that I was not, that I wish I was as wise as the day I was born.
Wow.
So open yourselves as far as you dare, like be a sheet of photographic paper, you know, it's unborn. Or your digital camera, it's the same. I mean, it's exactly what you want to point it at and the kind of an intention of how you want to feel it. And follow your bliss.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, Will.
Oh, my pleasure.
On this note, we'll see if we can get Kevin Locke back. And next Thursday, Coral Reef will be back with us. And I'm not sure yet who we're going to have on. Could be Will back again. Thank you for listening, and let's see if we can get Kevin Locke back on. Thank you.